From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Here and Now. Pentagon officials said today about 10,000 people are still waiting at the airport in Kabul as the U.S. continues its evacuation efforts in Afghanistan. More than 80,000 people have fled so far, most of them Afghans, and they're being flown to U.S. military bases that are struggling to accommodate them. One staging area, Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, has even been called a, quote, living hell. That's how one military official described it in an email to his colleagues, saying the floors were covered in, quote, trash, urine, fecal matter, spilled liquids, and vomit. Yesterday, Pentagon spokesman John Kirby had this to say.
Nobody here wants anyone to be less than safe, secure, comfortable, and well cared for as they go through this process. We take it very seriously, but we'll be the first to admit that there were conditions at Al Udeid could have been better. They are improving now. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that they're perfect, because they're not.
Let's bring in Steve Hendricks. He's the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for our editorial partners at The Washington Post, and he joins us from Doha, Qatar. Steve, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure, Celeste.
Steve, you've been to that airbase, I understand. What did you see?
Well, I haven't been inside because that's nearly impossible. So I can only report from the outside and probably more importantly, report what many of the Afghans who have been held there have told me directly, and even a lot of U.S. officials who are much more candid about this off the record than on the record. But my impressions from those reports are that it was a living hell. It got very, very bad. I think the worst stretch was at the end of last week and over the weekend when they really were overwhelmed with the numbers arriving here and not many people being flown on to next destination. So a real bottleneck formed here. I don't know if it became hazardous, but it became very close. We had reports of crowds getting a little bit out of hand. I think everybody had plenty of food, but there was only one real washroom or toilet in this huge main hangar. Terribly uncomfortable for these families that were already traumatized by the dangers they faced in Afghanistan and the literal life-threatening journey they had to make to the airport in Kabul.
It sounds like you're hinting like you agree with John Kirby that things have gotten better.
I think things began to get better right at the peak of it over the weekend. I think by Sunday, they had more portable toilets. They brought them from around the base. They commissioned more than 100 from around the country. They increased the number of beds in air conditioning to something like 3,000. And probably more importantly, the broader system expanded. There are now more places where planes from Kabul can land, including Kuwait and Germany. And they've picked up the pace of flights leaving here, either to the United States or to third countries. So the system is operating more efficiently than it was, and therefore the crush, the concentrated suffering in Doha is not as bad as it had been.
So the U.S. and Qatar made a deal to hold 8,000 Afghan refugees who had special immigrant visa status and their families. The airbase reached capacity last week, according to officials, and they had to temporarily halt incoming refugees. Can you tell me what was the process in the ideal situation that they planned for? What was this process supposed to look like?
I'm not sure there was a lot of planning, which is what's really surprised people. There's no question that they were not ready for even the number of evacuees that they agreed with Qatar would come here. Now, the U.S. military is very good at throwing a lot of logistics at a problem very quickly. And I think that's what we've seen in the last 2 weeks. And it did take some time for them to catch up to the needs. Hopefully they're doing that now. We're getting close to the tens of thousands now, and it's not clear how many more are yet to come. I mean, there's supposed to be a hard deadline on this, but that's very hard to imagine that it's just going to cut off in the next few days.
Have officials in Qatar responded at all to the situation at the airbase?
Well, they've now made other facilities available, which is actually beyond the agreement. The agreement was supposed to be limited to temporary housing in the U.S. side of the airbase. Now there are actually evacuees being housed on Qatari soil.
But as far as you know, those are temporary housing, and we're talking about families that will stay for a short time and then move on?
That's correct. Qatar has not agreed to permanently accept any of these evacuees as refugees or asylum seekers. This is all supposed to be just a way station on the way to some other processing that the U.S. is trying to facilitate.
Dare I ask if there are COVID protocols being followed?
Well, I think for the first week or so, no, not really. And they had come off a very crowded cargo flights and into a very crowded temporary housing in a hangar. We didn't see a tremendous amount of mask wearing. Now, they're beginning to catch up to that as well. Qatar's a very efficient health system. I know that there are groups of evacuees who are immediately tested, and then when they receive their test, they can enjoy more freedom. I don't know the extent of that in the least desirable housing in the hangar, but my sense is that those systems are also coming online.
Steve Hendricks is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for our editorial partners at The Washington Post, joining us from Qatar. Thank you so much, Steve.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, the rate of COVID-19 vaccinations in many Latin American countries now outpaces the U.S. That is a major shift from earlier this year. Colombia didn't receive its first doses until the end of February, months after the U.S., and its initial rollout struggled. But now more than a quarter of Colombians have been fully vaccinated, and the country's connections with South Florida may have something to do with it. WLRN's Tim Padgett explains.
Hola!
In May, Juliana Mejia, her husband, parents, and two children made two trips from their home city of Bogota, Colombia, to Broward County, Florida. Here they are playing on the beach in Fort Lauderdale.
Muy bien.
What Mejia and her family really came to Florida for were COVID vaccine shots. Mejia is 35, and Colombia wasn't vaccinating her age group yet. She runs an immigration counseling firm and spoke to me from Bogota.
We were thinking that we weren't going to get vaccinated till 2022, like late 2022, which is what triggered the decision to go to the U.S.
On April 30th, Florida ended its requirement that people prove they live here in order to get vaccinated. Suddenly, in May, there was a 75% increase in Colombians traveling to the U.S. Mejia recalls nurses joking about it when she got her Pfizer shots.
Oh, the people who would vaccinate us would laugh and say, oh, some more Colombians that are coming. We just vaccinated, I don't know how many Colombians.
Those Colombians have had an impact on the vaccination effort back in Colombia. Last winter, so-called vaccine tourists from developing countries were often criticized for using their middle and upper class resources to get the vaccines that so many of their fellow citizens couldn't get. Now there's a sense they've done something good. Dr. Carlos Espinal was a critic of vaccine tourism early on. He's from Colombia and heads the Global Health Consortium at Florida International University. Since then, he's changed his mind.
It has a positive impact because it increased the number of vaccines that become available for the Colombian population.
Dr. Espinal's own son and daughter came here from Colombia to get vaccinated. He realized vaccine tourists are actually helping people back home by freeing up more vaccine there, including the 6 million doses the Biden administration recently donated to Colombia.
I think the Colombians vaccinated in the U.S. also has an important role after returning to the country.
Take Juliana Mejia. She went back to Colombia talking about the lack of vaccination red tape in the U.S.
We were telling people like it's super easy. You didn't even have to make an appointment. Like in Colombia, they actually had to call you for an appointment. You couldn't just show up.
Dr. Espinal is in close contact with Colombia's health ministry. He says those reports from returning vaccine tourists have helped persuade Colombia to make its own vaccination system more accessible.
The government now is facilitating an open vaccination program with not any pre-registration restrictions and so on.
Meanwhile, Colombian vaccine tourists keep coming to South Florida.
In this year, in my house, I received 20 people.
Colombian expat Maria Eugenia Arbeláez is a retired teacher. Her home near Miami has become a free hostel of sorts for family and friends coming from Colombia to get vaccinated. She's also provided them lists of vaccination sites and contacts and which vaccines are being given where. Arbeláez told me she feels as though she's helping her home country fight COVID. We tell them to go home and be messengers of how fundamental it is to get vaccinated, she said, to tell Colombians not to waste this opportunity, and not waste it the way so many Americans have. The U.S. vaccination rate has fallen short of what health experts say is necessary to end the pandemic, and COVID cases and deaths are spiking again in Florida. Carolina Vasquez was another vaccine tourist from Bogota. She said she was stunned more South Floridians weren't taking advantage of their vaccine availability.
There wasn't even a line to get vaccinated. It's sad. Like, really? You don't know how many people in Colombia would kill to have gotten that vaccine months ago.
Vasquez says that the U.S. and other richer countries had begun donating vaccines to countries like Colombia months ago, vaccine tourism might not have been necessary in the first place. For Here and Now, I'm Tim Padgett in Miami.
You know, it may be the dog days of August, but it is anything but quiet in the world of politics. A Republican and a Democrat in Congress made a secret trip to Afghanistan overnight, and they concluded the U.S. will not be able to get all of its Afghan helpers evacuated by the time troops pull out next week. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has negotiated a way to keep her party unified on infrastructure spending for now. Our political strategists join us. Bill Press is a Democrat. Hi there, Bill.
Hi, Celeste. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you as well. Matt Makowiak is a Republican. Hi, Matt. Hello, Matt.
Hey there. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's start with Moulton and Meyer. Massachusetts Democrat Seth Moulton and Michigan Republican Peter Meyer. They're both veterans. They both served. They have been criticized for distracting from the evacuation efforts by making this secret trip to Kabul's airport. They say, though, that they went because the American public is not getting the full truth from the Biden administration. And I wonder, Bill, was this trip, do you think, worth it?
Well, let me say this. I think it's remarkable that we finally found something that Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy can agree on, which is that this was totally stupid and totally selfish on the part of one Democrat or one Republican to do this. They accomplished nothing. They didn't contribute anything to our relief efforts. All they did was get in the way. They said, we learned that we may not get everybody out by August 31. Duh. I mean, I know that. You know that. Everybody listening knows that. You don't have to go to Kabul to find it out. And worst of all, I think, you know, the member of Congress travels. They require security. They require handling. They require VIP treatment. And they require two seats. And there are two seats coming out of Kabul that were occupied by two members of Congress who could have been occupied by two Afghan refugees. Shame on them.
In a statement, though, Moulton and Meyer criticized the U.S. as what they called, quote, current bizarre relationship with the Taliban. Here's President Biden from last night.
The sooner we can finish, the better. Each day of operations brings added risk to our troops. But the completion by August 31st depends upon the Taliban continuing to cooperate and allow access to the airport for those who were transporting out and no disruptions to our operations.
Bill, I wonder, Matt, what you make of this criticism of the Biden administration's relationship and discussions with the Taliban. Is Biden administration, are they responsible for the chaos right now?
Well, there's no question that there was a right way to withdraw from the country, first by getting Americans out, second by taking care of these SIV folks who've helped us in country, and then third, by protecting our military assets in country, which have now fallen in the hands of the Taliban and made them among the better weaponized and supported terrorist groups, or certainly opponents of America. So they should have gone about this obviously much better. It is a little bit strange that the Taliban can now say, if we have to leave by the 31st, or there will be consequences. and that, you know, we basically have to sort of do whatever they want. That's kind of the position it appears that we're in. We shouldn't be letting the Taliban dictate to us when we can remove Americans from an unsafe situation. We should be making absolutely clear that we will get every American out we possibly can. The Brits and the French are already doing that. They're going well beyond the perimeter at the airport. And it seems to me, with the strongest and most fearsome military in the world, if we had the willpower at the top levels of our government, we could do that ourselves.
How fair is it, though, for people to be criticizing the Biden administration for having discussions with the Taliban, Bill, when the treaty with the withdrawal was negotiated by the Trump administration, and let's not forget the Bush administration and the Obama administration?
I think it's just, honestly, and I agree with a lot of what Matt said in terms of, I just want to make that point of, we shouldn't be listening to the Taliban. I mean, whatever they say, look, we are the far superior military force, the largest and most powerful on the planet. So I take everything I think we all should, the Taliban is saying about, you know, we got to be out by August 31 or whatever. I think we ought to take that all with a grain of salt. But of course we have to talk to the Taliban. They did take over the country after 20 years. They're in charge right now. We have to talk to them, if nothing else, than to make sure that we can accomplish our mission of getting all the people out. And Celeste, you rightfully point out, the deal to get out of the country was not made by Joe Biden. It was made by Donald Trump in February 2020, who wanted to invite the Taliban to Camp David to sign an agreement. And he made a deal with them that we would pull out our troops with no conditions, no preconditions, no nothing. We'd be out by May 2020. And that's what started this whole collapse.
Still, though, although most Americans say they approve of the idea of getting out of Afghanistan, a USA Today Suffolk poll that came out yesterday shows the president's approval rating has dropped to 41%, and a majority disapprove of the way the Biden administration has handled it. Matt, do you think this is a lasting drop in support for President Biden's administration, or is this maybe going to be temporary?
I think there's two ways to answer that. First, I think, look, part of why his approval rating has dropped so fast is that this has been dominating the news, and it's a very difficult story, has a lot of bad images. And honestly, I don't think the White House has been totally upfront and honest with the public. And I don't think the president's messaging, his inability to answer questions or unwillingness to answer questions has cost him somewhat as well. But if they're able to ultimately get all or the vast majority of Americans out by August 31st, I do think some of that controversy may die down. The longer term risk is what kind of government does the Taliban build? Does Al Qaeda or ISIS-K come back into the country? Do they start launching attacks? Do terrorists are they able to enter through the United States to the southern border at the moment, which Homeland Security officials are concerned about? There are some longer term risks here for Biden. I don't think Afghanistan is going to dominate the way it has for the last 10 days, for the next, you know, 2 or 3 months. But I do think it's put the administration on defense. It's made congressional Democrats start to question the administration's approach here. And it has, I think, moved independence away from Biden and willing to consider, you know, other options done in the future. So they're on defense right now. The question is how long this will last and whether they can get to a satisfactory conclusion.
Well, let's move back. So, go ahead, Bill.
Just a quick point. I just wanted to point out, as we all know, there's no such thing as a lasting poll, right? I saw this morning that President Obama's poll numbers dived in the middle of Somalia, when it turned out to be not the crisis we thought it was, his numbers went back up. We're now in the middle of probably the most successful and the greatest airlift in history. Almost 100,000 people now brought out of Afghanistan. If that continues at that pace, Joe Biden will get credit for it and his numbers will come back up.
Well, let's bring the discussion back to Washington, D.C. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, celebrated an agreement she reached last night with moderates in her party to vote on a bipartisan infrastructure deal next month in exchange for their yes votes on a much larger $3.5 trillion budget resolution that paves the way for a host of the president's priorities. This morning, she downplayed the divides within the party.
The steam that was in our caucus was to get this done. For the president, for the American people, for America's working families. And our unity, as I always say, our diversity is our strength. Our unity is our power.
Matt, how big a victory is this for her?
Yeah, I mean, it's significant because it opens the door to the spending bill that Biden and many of the progressive Democrats want to get done. They had to get this piece done. Now they have to pass the infrastructure bill, I think, by the 27th. September's going to be a very busy month. You've got the debt ceiling. You've got all kinds of things. All these things are combining. The infrastructure bill, the budget resolution, the budget reconciliation bill, all these things are combining. So it's either going to all come together beautifully and they're going to take a victory lap, or it's all going to fall apart in a chaotic way. And I don't think we know right now. It was a win for Pelosi. Yesterday was pretty chaotic. The day before was pretty chaotic, where they had to pull the rule down from the House floor. But they ultimately got there. She got the deal she needed with the moderates. And give her credit, she doesn't lose votes on the floor. It rarely happens in the House, but it has happened in the past. She does not lose votes on the floor, and you have to give her credit for that.
So, Bill, what do you think here? Is a very short window here of success before we start heading into the midterms?
Let me just say, kind of building on what Matt said, Democrats, Republicans, and the media always have made the mistake of underestimating Nancy Pelosi. Big mistake. Boy, she knows how to deliver. She is a master at legislation. And she engineered this, bringing the progressives and the moderates both behind both measures, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure measure, which will be voted on by September 27, and now the $3.5 billion budget, plus voting rights on top of that. Matt's right. There are a lot of hurdles to go over before any one of these becomes law. But I would put my trust in Nancy Pelosi to get them all through the House, certainly, and then it's up to Chuck Schumer to get them through the Senate.
I got to get your response to that, Matt, and I know we have less than a minute left, but does Nancy Pelosi have the time to get some of these bills through her House, at least, before we start heading into the midterm elections?
Yeah, it feels like they punted the tough decisions and the tough work that they have to do to September. That's the thing. And now you have the debt ceiling deadline as well. So all these deadlines are coming together and the stakes are really high.
Matt Mikowiak is a Republican strategist. Bill Press is a Democratic strategist. Thanks, guys.
Hey, thanks, Celeste.
NPR's Planet Money Summer School is in session. This season is all about investing. Like, is it better to buy a lot of one stock or a little bit of a lot of stocks? What are bonds? Is it ever too late to start investing? New classes every Wednesday till Labor Day in the Planet Money podcast feed.
A rapidly growing wildfire is approaching the pristine shores of Lake Tahoe today. The Caldor Fire in California has burned more than 126,000 acres since it ignited on August 14th. Cal Fire Chief Tom Porter now calls it the top priority in the country for firefighters. Joining us now is Scott Rodd. He's a reporter for Cap Radio in Sacramento. Scott, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And how serious is the threat to Lake Tahoe?
You know, it's a serious threat that this fire is moving into more densely populated areas. Not only the fire is a threat, but also the smoke as well. I mean, we're seeing very high, very hazardous air moving into that area. The AQI, which measures pollution, is, upwards of 400, 450, and over 300 is considered hazardous.
Which is a big deal because Lake Tahoe is a resort town. It's famous around the world for its beauty. It's just absolutely gorgeous. And as you describe, there's ash and there's smoke in the air. How bad is it to breathe in person?
Oh, it's bad. I mean, going outside, you can feel it. I mean, the air, you can chew on the air up there. It's bad. And, folks are leaving the area. I've spoken to folks who have canceled or are considering canceling going up there. And it's both a resort area, but also an area that is iconic for its outdoor natural tourism. So this is definitely a hit for the region, but also California as a whole.
And so Tahoe on alert, but other nearby towns are actually already feeling the wrath of this fire. You spoke with Patty Van Schoik, who had to evacuate from Pollock Pines, which is a town about 40 miles to the west of Tahoe.
Just making sure we can get what we can. And my husband was able to get home and pull the trailer out. And This is scary. That my, you know, talking to relatives down the hill, I don't think my heart has stopped just beating out of my chest.
How destructive has this fire been so far?
It's been very destructive. We saw explosive growth in the early days of the fire, you know, at times growing by 40,000 plus acres in just a day's span, which is a remarkably fast moving fire. It's destroyed about 500 homes, and we have another 17,000 structures threatened. So it's been very destructive. It's leveled an entire town, Grizzly Flats.
It's one of just about a dozen large wildfires that's burning in California right now. How busy are the fire crews up there? How stretched thin are they?
Very stretched thin. I mean, they're at capacity. You know, bouncing from one fire to another, there's this sort of tug of war between the zero sum tug of war between all the resources, where whichever fire pops up is the most urgent, you know, they're shepherding crews, engines, aircraft as well between these fires. So, you know, we're seeing what we saw last year, which is, you know, fatigue setting in. It's very grueling fires that they're working in really tough terrain under really harsh conditions.
And just briefly, Scott, what are the conditions? What's the forecast in the next couple of days, weeks?
You know, fortunately, the weather has relented a little bit from the beginning of this fire. However, we're still looking at very hot conditions, very dry conditions. And over the weekend for the Caldor fire, it looks like the winds might pick up a little bit. So that's always a red flag for folks who are fighting the fires on the front lines.
And of course, an ongoing drought across the region. Scott Rodd, reporter at Cap Radio in Sacramento, thank you for your reporting.
Thank you.
The new film Together begins on March 24th of 2020, the first full day of COVID-19 lockdown in London. A couple, played by James McAvoy and Sharon Horgan, prepare to quarantine with their young son. They have their groceries, their toilet paper, just about everything they might need, but there's one glaring problem.
The only thing keeping us together is our child.
Arthur.
Little Artie.
His name's Arthur.
Yeah, if it wasn't for little Artie, we would have split up years ago.
The truth is, we just can't stand each other. So this lockdown, being in the same house together,
only thing that makes living with her even remotely bearable is knowing that I get to leave this house every day.
I feel exactly the same.
Together follows this couple through the following year as they have to negotiate with each other and the losses that accompany the pandemic. The film opens in theaters Friday, and joining me now is the writer of the film, Dennis Kelly. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
I found myself as I was watching the film wondering how this started for you, because it could have been you trying to exercise some of your own pandemic ghosts, or it could have been you reaching out to others to share a common experience.
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of both of those things and some other stuff as well. I mean, writing is just therapy in a lot of ways. So you end up sort of writing stuff out of you, and you hope that it's not too awful for other people to see, you know. I mean, I think I didn't particularly want to write anything about lockdown. It just sort of happened, you know. And when I was writing, I didn't even know what it was. It was weird because I'm a playwright as well. So I write for theatre, I write for film, and I write for TV. And I had no idea. Normally, you absolutely know whether you're writing one or the other. And all the way through, it was like I was looking at this thinking, is this a play? I don't think it's a play, you know. And then I'd go think it's a film. No, it's not. I don't know. Is it a... In the end, I think you're getting the best version of it because you're getting the big screen version of it. And I think what a big screen can do is it just can give you the intimacy. Like the moment when Sharon is sort of describing the what happens to her mum, and I don't want to give too much away, but some of the sort of more personal moments. I mean, I just think you needed to be up and close with that, you know?
They also, those moments sort of come as a surprise to me anyway. And I was wondering how much thought you gave to the way this film will be viewed in the years ahead. Because there's the way we feel about it now when many people probably feel like they're still there, right? And how it might feel when this becomes more of a historical document.
To be honest, I've not thought about that at all. I mean, the strange thing about writing it is that, you know, you're writing about the only event that I can think of that the entire world has shared, you know, because of the knock-on economic effects, or whether it's because you've got people who died or you died, or whether it's because you're wearing a mask, you know, it's something that is, so it's this kind of huge, colossal event. And it just changed all the time. It was, as I was writing it, it was just changing all the time. So I think I had to be very careful about what I chose to write about. There's been so many times while making it, I've been thinking, we're too late here. We're too late. We should have done this 2 months ago, 3 months ago, 4 months ago, 5 months ago. But it's not true. It's really weird. The sort of longer it goes, I think the more, weirdly, the more relevant it becomes, because it kind of documents those early days, you know, and we've forgotten them. You know, we've really forgotten them. Certainly in the UK, you know, we've really forgotten what it was like to walk down a street and the person opposite you, you know, try and stay 2 meters apart from you, and you try and stay 2 meters. We don't do that now, you know what I mean? There's a whole bunch of stuff we don't do now that we did then. And I think it's really important that we, it is important that we remember, because there's a whole lot of processing to go on.
It's interesting that you say this, though, because there's so many moments in the film, and the film is honestly, this is one of the few authentically drama comedies, dramedies I've seen where it's actually equally balanced. Very often they lie about that. They call it a dramedy, but right, there's not much that's funny in there. But it's interesting that there are moments where even just a year later, we can look back and think, oh, holy cow, they have no idea what they're in for. And I'm thinking about those very first moments of the movie when they're clearly preparing to lock down for they don't know how long, but they obviously don't think it's going to be that long. And it's almost like watching a film where people are getting onto the Hindenburg expecting a great trip.
It sort of is. It sort of is. But it was like that, though, right? I mean, it was sort of like, you know, we didn't really know what we had in store for us. I mean, part of the reason for writing it was I felt very frustrated with a lot of the kind of, in early lockdown, certainly in the UK, you know, there was so much kind of like positivity and like, hey, we're going to get through this. And it was all right to be positive if you had a certain type of job. But I mean, there was a quote, someone on Twitter had said, there was no lockdown. There was just working class people bringing things to middle class people. So the working people were out there slaving away, you know, putting their life on the line all the time because they had to. That was their jobs, you know. And if you worked in a supermarket, you didn't have a chance to sort of work from home, you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. And I'm glad you brought this up because without giving away much, this idea, a reconsideration and a new appreciation of the working class and what they do for us every day is a huge theme in the movie. I mean, you know, it's so cliche to ask someone how much of this is based on your real life, but I had to wonder at that point if this was part of your story, if this brought you a new appreciation for the people who deliver your food and stock the grocery shelves or someone close to you.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, my background is I'm from a, quite a working class background. I left school very young, and like I did a stream of jobs that I hated. I worked in supermarkets, and I didn't, you know, and I packed veg, and I did all the. I was unskilled, you know. I had no qualifications, and somehow I bumbled into writing sort of in my early 30s, and you know, I was very lucky that it stuck. But at the same time, there I was. I couldn't help but look at my job and think, I've got a really useless job. Like, there's all these people that are keeping society moving. I kept thinking, this is the end. This is the end for the playwrights and the screenwriters and, you know, the entrepreneurs and all of this. This is the end. This is the revolution. This is when it all changes, because everyone's going to realise how useless we are, and all the people who are actually doing stuff, this is not going to go back to normal. And it just did. It just all went back to normal. It just snapped back to normal. It was like, thanks very much. You know, we all applauded, didn't we? The nurses and the doctors. We sort of said, thanks very much. We didn't change anything. We didn't change their pay. I mean, we just forgot a lot of that stuff. And it just seemed to me that it wouldn't be possible for it to go back to the way it was. And unfortunately, it did. It has, you know.
Which is not part of the movie. We don't get to that point in the film. But we do get to this point of both of them sort of reconsidering what matters in their relationships, especially with each other, of course, because they're stuck together and they hate each other. But it seems to me like they sort of rethink what matters in terms of compatibility with another person. They're kind of changing their core values in a way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff that was going on in my sort of head that was not necessarily pandemic related as well. And I think it was, you know, there's such an anger in our politics at the moment. I mean, I know that you guys have had it in such an intense way in the US, but...
What? What are you talking
we've
about?
We've had it here. You know, but we've had it here as well. Like, it's angry. You know, we've had Brexit and all these kind of stuff. And, you know, we're getting to a point where we're no longer looking at the other side as quite human. And, you know, I'm a sort of a lefty, you know what I mean? But I'm sort of slightly disgusted with my own sort of side for kind of, you know, looking at the other side as, well, less than human, you know, because the moment you start doing that, it becomes really possible to start thinking terrible things. And then it starts becoming possible to start doing terrible things. Those steps aren't really that far away, you know, once you sort of stop seeing people as human, you know. I'm not saying that this is what this is about, but I felt like the couple in it, one is a Tory, which is a conservative, you know, and one is a Bernie Sanders voter, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's sort of, so they're kind of like the exact people that should not be together. But what I kind of liked was the idea that they could somehow find a way to be together. I mean, they are a couple, you know what I mean? And it just feels like the other half are not going away. Republicans are not going away. Democrats are not going away. That's just not going to happen. So we do need to find a way to sort of try and communicate with each other and speak with each other.
I guess that's how you end up with the title of the film, which is Together. Because sometimes that's unwilling togetherness, right?
Yeah. And certainly with this couple, you know, with this couple, it feels like they're going to, that's not the state it feels like they're going to be.
Yeah, they're always on the edge of, as soon as this is over, it's bye-bye. Dennis Kelly is the author of the screenplay of the new film, Together. Dennis, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Celeste. It was really nice.
Together opens in theaters Friday. For more information on the film and to see a trailer, go to hereandnow.org.
We've said this many times, but it remains true. Every person who has died from COVID-19 is more than a statistic. They were our friends, our family members, our partners and spouses, coworkers and neighbors. Every one of them had a story worth telling. Stephanie Wolf from member station WFPL reports on a project in Kentucky to do just that.
When Evelyn Richard met her husband Ray in the 70s, they lived hundreds of miles apart.
He was actually in Walton, visiting a friend.
That's Walton, Kentucky, in Boone County, where Evelyn lives.
I saw Ray in the congregation at the church and asked who he was, and then we were introduced.
They went on a date. There was a spark, so they kept in touch.
We didn't have texting, and we would talk to each other on the phone occasionally, but it was long distance, so that was expensive. So we would write letters.
And in 1978, after a few months of correspondence, they got engaged, married the next year. They kept the letters tucked away in shoeboxes for decades. After Ray died from COVID in November, Evelyn pulled out those letters. She spent hours reading them.
It made me feel like he was still here in a way, and also reconfirmed how much we loved each other.
Richard is one of about 50 people who shared their memories on a website called Who We Lost Kentucky. It's a repository of remembrances of people killed by the coronavirus. Each submission is written by a loved one or friend.
What made you want to participate?
Just because so many people still think that it's not serious. I mean, there's some people that even say that it's fake. You know, well, it's not fake because I lost the love of my life.
In her submission, Evelyn writes that she misses her husband every day. Quote, "My heart is forever his."
It seems to me that for those who have not lost someone, they may feel things are back to normal.
That's Who We Lost Kentucky founding director and writer Martha Greenwald.
Every ad on TV is about reunions and about coming out of the pandemic. But for someone who's lost someone to COVID, that reunion's not going to happen.
Greenwald says we're still in this pandemic, despite easing restrictions and vaccines being widely available for people 12 and up. She got the idea for the project during one of Kentucky's COVID briefings last fall. State Public Health Commissioner Dr. Stephen Stack asked people to send him snail mail, sharing how they felt about the pandemic.
Now, email doesn't count because it's too easy, and I don't respond to people on Twitter, so don't even bother with that. But you want to take the time to make up a note card and send a note card to me. I'll look over those. I'll look over every one of them.
And he called it a writing assignment. And something went off in my head at that moment. I knew there was something more to this than what he was asking for.
Greenwald thought about how COVID changed the grieving process, especially earlier in the pandemic, when people couldn't hold in-person funerals, shivas, memorials. You couldn't be there with your loved one in their final moments. So she wanted to create a place that might offer some comfort to those who are mourning, as well as a place for remembrance. And here's how Who We Lost Kentucky works. You fill out a form on the site to submit a story.
It also has what we call a writing toolkit,
equipped with downloadable PDFs of writing prompts and general tips to help get people going.
I don't edit what comes in.
But she does review submissions. Greenwald wants to make sure everything is appropriate before she hits publish.
I wanted it to be something that the writer could quickly see the results of what they had done and not feel that it was, you know, mediated by someone.
Evelyn Richard is glad she got to be the one to write her husband's story for the site.
Well, it was just important for me to express his unconditional love for me. I wanted to share that.
She's also grateful she kept those letters, her own archive of her husband's affections.
I can't overemphasize, you know, how important it is just to write things down.
Plans are in the works to publish the stories from the Who We Lost Kentucky project as an anthology in the near future. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Wolf in Louisville.
Tributes continue today for rock and roll legend Charlie Watts, drummer for the Rolling Stones. He died yesterday at the age of 80. Bill Janovitz, singer and guitarist with the band Buffalo Tom, wrote two books about the Rolling Stones, Exile on Main Street and Rocks Off. He says Watts' steady drumming often contrasted with the flamboyance of the band's frontman, Mick Jagger.
Elegance is the word that always comes to mind, and austerity is part of elegance to me when you're talking about Charlie Watts. And that extended from his personality, by all accounts, through the way he dressed and conducted himself and the way he drummed.
Janovitz says Watts' low-key style also extended to his personal and family life.
Charlie offered this, in the biggest rock and roll band in the world, he offered this this other, you don't have to be the most decadent Keith Moon or Robert Plant or whatever. You don't have to be that sort of unreachable kind of rock star. You can be just a workman-like domestic guy, go home to normal life and then play in the most amazing band and be an absolute gentleman and kind man throughout the whole thing.
Musician and author Bill Janovitz remembering Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Celeste Headlin.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.